Welcome to Under the Tamarind Tree. Under the Tamarind Tree features great ambassadors and world changers for Montserrat and the Caribbean. Listen as you learn about their lives and the music they love. Welcome to Under the Tamarind Tree.
Our guest this week, Under the Tamarind Tree, is Abigail Kelly, international soprano. Welcome, Under the Tamarind Tree, Abigail.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
It's delightful to have you under the tamarind tree. Have you had any tamarind tree experiences?
I don't think I have, to be honest. I think this is my first tamarind tree experience. But from what I gather about being under the tamarind tree, being as a focal point of people getting together, I think that being in my church choir would have been like being under the tamarind tree when I was 11.
And when you sing, because I know you sing to large audiences, is that a tamarind tree type experience?
I suppose it could be, actually. You feel like you're under the umbrella of everybody that's listening to you and watching you, and they're wishing you all goodwill while you're on stage. So, yes.
And we have you under the tamarind tree because this is going to be a very special one. And you will share with us the music that you love, the Christmas music that you love.
Yes.
But before you get to that, we hear a lot about you and your singing. And we would just like to find out, what sort of little girl were you?
I was quite, I wouldn't say I was precocious at all, but I enjoyed performing and I enjoyed watching performances. So from a very early age, my parents encouraged me to be musical. I played the piano from the age of 4. I went to dance school at the age of 4 until about 19 years old. I studied the violin for a short while, although that I found that that wasn't really my instrument. I wasn't making a very good sound on the violin, so I abandoned that. I joined my local church choir when I was about 11, and I played in various orchestras and bands at school. So it was quite a natural progression, a natural decision for me to take this on as a career. It was a decision that my parents actually didn't agree with at first, but they are now one of my my biggest fans.
And you speak of your parents, and you speak of your local church and your local community. Which is your local community?
Birmingham. So for many years. And I will probably on Midnight Mass as well, and maybe this show would have gone out already, but maybe on Sunday I would have been singing at the local church at their carol service, if I'm not too jet-lagged from this trip. yes, so that's my local church choir, and it's there where I learnt a lot about music. In fact, my piano teacher was the wife of the choir master. So from a very early age, I was involved in that church musically. And it was a natural progression, therefore, that at the age of 11, my piano teacher said, well, why don't you come and sing on the choir? And I thought, okay, I didn't think I really sang very well. I had a very, very quiet voice when I was little. People would try and get me to sing louder in school. But what I had was a very sweet, quiet, natural voice. So it developed, having been in the choir since the age of 11. That's where my voice really, really developed.
You mentioned a little bit about school already. Tell us a little bit more about your time at school.
I had a lovely time at school. I went to a junior school, which was a private junior school, so there weren't very many children in the school. I think there were 11 children in my class, which in England is very, you know, very rare. Usually you have a school classroom full of 30 to 32 children, 28 maybe the minimum. But we had a very, very small number of children in our class. So everyone got a lot of attention, and we were very much encouraged by this teacher at our school called Mrs. Slaymaker, which is a fantastic name for this time of year. Mrs. Slaymaker. And she would, every year, she would put on dancing and singing extravaganza at the school. We'd have this school show at the end of the year. And she really encouraged us to explore singing and dance and drama and explore our talents. And I thank her for that, because that was a great experience to have inside school, as well as the experiences that I had at dance school when I was a little girl too. So growing up for me was a lot of fun. Lots of going to school in the morning, doing all my academic work, and then coming back and going to, it might be piano lessons on one day, going to dance school a couple of times a week. Eventually I'd go to choir rehearsals up to twice a week. I'd go to church, sing in the choir twice on a Sunday. So it was a heavy schedule of activities, extracurricular activities that were mainly based around music. And then I'd go to piano lessons outside of school as well. And by the time I got to senior school, I was doing so many things outside of school. We were able to get me involved in learning the violin inside of school, which made a big difference. So that was really, really useful to do. But as I said, the violin just was not my instrument. I didn't play it very well at all. So I soon left that behind and concentrated on the singing.
And you mentioned school, who inspired you at school, but what about at home?
Oh, well, definitely my parents inspired me. Because I'm an only child, there wasn't really anybody else around on a constant, regular basis in terms of older siblings to look up to. So I very much was aware of my parents, what my parents did, what my parents listened to in terms of music. They're the reason, really, for my, I think, my love of classical music, both them and the church, because they were really instrumental in making sure that when I was as young as, I think I went to my first opera at the age of about 9, something like that, maybe even younger. And I remember those experiences very well. They made sure I went to go and see operas. I went to see musicals. I went to see pantomimes that were, you know, really specifically designed for children. So I had a very wide experience of watching performances, seeing live music happen. I'd go and see orchestras. So I got a lot of my love of the genre of music that I work in from my parents.
And I can't resist asking you, what was that first opera that you saw?
I think it was Aida, actually. That was the first one I saw. It was quite a big one to see for such a young age. But I don't think I understood it, but I enjoyed the spectacular nature of it. Mm-hmm. It's such a big opera. It really, really is. I don't really remember having a specific feeling towards the voices or the voice types or the people that were on stage. I just remember the general feeling of being quite overwhelmed by it all, because it was such a big occasion.
And this would be a lovely time, a lovely occasion to have your first bit of music that you would like to share with us.
Yes. Well, a lot of these pieces of music I've chosen, the first few especially, are songs that I sing at choir at this time of year. So even though I don't go to my church choir on a regular basis, because I'm usually off touring the world, I come back and I sing with them at Christmas, very importantly at Christmas. And this first one we do every year, it's called Riu Riu Chiu. And it's a traditional Spanish Christmas carol in honor of the Virgin Mary. And it's derived from medieval dance forms from the 15th century. And this one in particular, I'll tell you what the words are. Riu Riu Chiu La Guadaribera. Dios guarda el lobo de nuestra cordera. And that means the river banks protect Our Lady. The God keeps Our Lady from the wolf. God keeps Our Lady from the wolf. So usually the men sing all the verses and the women sing the refrain along with the men. And we usually laugh at the men for trying to get all the Spanish words, which they sometimes don't quite get out quite right. So we're quite happy that we only have to sing the refrain.
Riu, riu, chiu, la guarda ribera, Dios guarda el lobo de nuestra cordera.
You've just heard Rio Rio Chio, a traditional Spanish carol, and I'm speaking to Miss Abigail Kelly, soprano. So you left school.
Yes.
School seemed as if it was delightful.
It was wonderful.
And you left school and you went on to do what?
Well, I left school and I had the intention of going on to do genetic research. Something like that. I was very interested in genetic research and people with genetic illnesses that they may pass on to their children and how you go about not really rectifying those illnesses, but maybe screening for those illnesses. However, there was this big conflict within me because there was this part of me that was very, very musical and had been from that early age. So all I really wanted to do was sing. And I spoke to my teacher about it, my headmistress, Miss Inch, at King Edward VI, Handsworth Grammar School for Girls. And she called my parents into the office and they said, look, your daughter is talented. I think you need to pursue this and this is the way we're going to go about it. And I went and I took a year out, took some time, took some perspective, and I auditioned for music college and got into Birmingham Conservatoire with a scholarship, which was wonderful for my parents because I live in Birmingham and based in Birmingham, have lived in Birmingham all my life. So I actually didn't really move away for my university degree. So I was able to keep up going to my local church choir and keep up a contact with all of the local things that I did. So I went to Birmingham Conservatoire, spent 4 years there, did my undergraduate degree, had a wonderful time, lots of hard work and lots of fun all at the same time. We did a lot of musical theatre as well, which I then had another bit of a dilemma in terms of, do I go down the musical theatre route or do I go down the classical and more specifically the operatic route? So I kind of made up my decision. I think I've made up my mind now because mainly I sing in operatic groups. But there's still parts of me that likes to sing a bit of musical theatre. In fact, in the concert that I gave in Montserrat just a few days ago, I did a couple of musical theatre pieces, one called Johnny One Note, which was quite funny because apparently there's a Calypsonian or a Calypso person who's vying for the crown who was called One Note. So that was a bit of a coincidence. But yes, so I went to music college. I left Birmingham Conservatoire with a with an undergraduate degree, first class undergraduate degree. In fact, I graduated with the highest marks in my year. And that journey carried me through to do a postgraduate degree at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama in Glasgow, which was another very interesting time in my academic musical life.
Seems as if it all just happened.
Yes.
You know, it just rolled from one thing to the next.
Yes, it did.
Were there challenges?
Oh, yes, most definitely.
How did you overcome these?
Well, I think the main challenge for any singer is that there are just so many, you're surrounded by so many fantastic singers, so many. The competition out there is really, really great. So in order to even get to the point where I'm at, which is, you know, I'm pretty much starting out on my career, it takes a lot of hard work and energy and effort and sacrifice, all those, especially when you have friends that I went to my senior school with, who I still am in very close contact with. We're very good friends, we're very close. Because they're not operating in the industry that I'm operating in, they have to develop an understanding that I can't be out until 2 o'clock in the morning. I have to make sure that I'm in bed and that I'm well rested, that I look after my voice. I can't be in smoky environments. In fact, the smoking ban in the UK was an absolute godsend for singers. It really, really was. We were able to go out and socialize without having to breathe in smoke from other people and have that affect your voice. So there's a lot of sacrifice in terms of, you know, your friends will go out to things and you have to go, I can't go out tonight. I've got to rest my voice because I've got a song class in the morning. There's other sacrifices as well. For example, now when I go out, I'm touring with an opera company, with English Touring Opera. And I like to say that as soon as my contract starts, my life is theirs, basically. So I'll travel around the country and I'll perform for adults. I'll perform in children's operas. And mainly I'll perform on Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays, kind of weekend days. And then on the Sundays, I'll be jetting from one end of the country to another end of the country. So when my friends who have 9-to-5 Monday to Friday jobs are ready to go out and socialize at the weekend, I have to again say, I'm so sorry, but I'm actually in Cardiff, or I'm in Perth and I'm performing that night, or I'm driving back that day, or lots of things like weddings and, you know, baptisms and christenings that I've not been able to be at for my very good friends because of this job, but I love it so much and they're very understanding. So it's important that my friendship base is very understanding about what I do as well.
Do you find that sometimes people wonder if this is a job at all?
Well, I do wonder sometimes in good ways and in bad ways, because I get the opportunity to come to amazing places like this. I remember there's one job in particular that I still think about. I went and did an opera in Bollington, which is a village in the UK, in the north of the UK, near Manchester and Macclesfield. And the hospitality, just like the hospitality here has been, was just so warm. I was well fed, I was well looked after. I opened my window in the morning, I saw fields, I saw cows, just like it has been while I've been here. You open your window in the morning and there's the sea and there's mango trees and there's guava. And and those experiences, you say to yourself, I can't believe that this is a job. I can't believe that I'm actually, you know, privileged enough to not only do what I love doing, but I earn a living from what I love doing, and I get to go to the most amazing places as well. So that's the positive side of it. And sometimes the negative side of it is that, you know, unlike a 9-to-5 job and a job where you get paid on a regular basis, you know, at the end of the month, every month, you get a certain amount that goes into your bank account and you know how to budget for the rest of the month or even for the rest of the year in terms of what you want to do, how you want to save your money. For my career, it's very much when a job comes, and with that your income comes. So you may have a period of time that you don't have a job for a month or so. You have to find other ways of earning a living. I do that by teaching on a regular basis as well as performing. So yes, that can be a challenge. And sometimes, yes, I think, oh my gosh, is this the job to do? But all the good points outweigh the bad points.
And this is a good time for us to have your second bit of music.
Yes. So my second bit of music is the Pastoral Symphony from Handel's Messiah. Every year for the last 10 years, I've chosen this because my dad has been a massive fan of the City of Birmingham Choir. They perform Handel's Messiah every year at Symphony Hall. And I think this is his 10th year that he has gone without fail. And I went with him this year. I haven't actually gone to one before. I went with him this year and it was a fantastic experience. And at this point in the Messiah, the Pastoral Symphony, it's an orchestral piece. And it comes from part one, scene four, which is the Annunciation to the Shepherds of the Birth of Jesus.
You've just heard the Pastoral Symphony from Handel's Messiah, and I'm speaking to Abigail Kelly, soprano, who is sharing her Christmas music with us. And so, Abigail, you've spoken to us about your career, and we've been listening keenly, and we're wondering, you know, you mentioned that you were happy when they had the ban on cigarette smoking because that was helpful to your voice. And we wonder how do you look after the voice? You know, is the voice separated from you and the way you look after yourself?
Oh, your voice is your instrument and your voice is part of your body, so you have to look after the whole of your body in order to look after your voice. I try and make sure I eat as healthily as I possibly can, just to make sure that my energy levels are up and, you know, that I can really give a performance to the best of my ability. There's no point in fueling yourself on junk food and then trying to think that you can get through a performance, a three-hour performance sometimes. And it's not even just getting through the performance, it's actually getting through a whole day of, you know, going up and down. Just as with any other job, a 9-to-5 job, a manual labour job, it all takes a lot of energy. What people don't realise is that when you see people on stage, you see them at 7:30 until 10 o'clock at night, and that's the period of time that you are viewing them. However, their work has started a lot earlier in the day than that. For example, I mentioned that I tour with the touring opera company quite a lot. So my touring day will be waking up in the morning very early, going to get my train or driving to the venue for 1 o'clock, which is when I sign in at the theatre that I'm performing in that day. I then have to take all of my bags that I've carried, find the hotel or the guest house that I've been staying in, do a warm-up, find a vocal warm-up, that is, find lunch from somewhere, come back to the theatre for about 4:20 for any dance rehearsals or any musical rehearsals that we may be called in for. I then have to go for what is called a balance call, which is on stage with all the singers and all of the orchestra, where we go through pivotal bits of the opera that may cause problems in terms of sound, that we have to go through and just check that we can hear the singers, or if the orchestra is too loud, the orchestra comes down, or if the singers need to project a bit more, that's what that time is for. We then go from that into trying to find some dinner, bearing in mind that we're in different venues all across the country, so it's a bit of a trek. It's never something that, okay, I know that down the road there is this. So you always have to be prepared to make sure that you can find dinner from somewhere, and finding a healthy dinner while you're on tour again is quite important and sometimes quite difficult when shops close at a certain time and you technically finish your rehearsal maybe sometimes after the shops have closed. So after that, we make sure we're back at the theatre, in hair, in makeup. We've got to be there from about half an hour before the performance begins. So it's a lot of dedicating time to preparing yourself. A lot of energy is spent being rushing up and down all of the day, and that's even before the first beat of the performance has been played, and that's at 7:30 usually. And then sometimes, being in the chorus, you're not even on until a little way into the opera. So you then have to make sure you've given yourself enough energy so that you've actually got enough energy to sit around and wait and maintain your focus, maintain your energy, so that when you do get to go on stage, you can give a really solid performance. So looking after the body energy-wise is very important. Looking after the body in order to maintain good vocal quality is very important. So I drink lots of water. Plenty of ginger tea. I found I love ginger tea because ginger is a natural anti-inflammatory. So if I'm ever feeling a bit sore in my throat, I'll get some ginger tea, whether it's the instant things that are imported from the Caribbean and Africa over to the UK. I make sure I have my ginger tea whenever I go on tour. But I've been very fortunate enough while I've been here to have some really nice fresh boiled ginger tea, which has been wonderful. And when I'm at home in the UK, we have ginger readily available. So when I have time, it's about having time as well, I do make sure I have some nice fresh ginger tea. So it's a lot about looking after yourself vocally, naturally, being healthy, having a healthy lifestyle, and then also being physically fit enough to maintain a healthy body to be running up and down on stage. Sometimes you're on stage and you're constantly moving, constantly going. There are some roles in operas, for example, Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro, where she is on stage constantly. So she has to have that energy. She has to be physically fit in order to be on that stage for 3 hours.
And in telling us all of that, we hear you use the term opera. And yes. You're an operatic singer. And there's some people under the tree who are very familiar, and I know that there's some people sitting here who have been off to Venice and they've been off to other places in Europe to see operatic presentations in the natural and so on. But then there's some who don't know a thing about it, or some who have heard a little bit of it and just find that it's distant. So please fill us in on that.
I always tell people that opera is just like soap opera. Mm-hmm. It has the same word in it as well. Mm-hmm. It would have been the earlier version of coming and sitting down to your favorite story and having that story told to you. But in opera, that story is told to you in a way where you have music, you have an orchestra, and it's all sung. It's all sung. So the drama is the same, the themes are the same, there's adultery and there's murder and there's scandal and intrigue and incest and this, that and the other. It's very powerful themes, and sometimes it can be very light-hearted themes. So there can be jovial operas, operas about villages in the UK having a summer fete and all of the craziness that surrounds this one village. This is Benjamin Britten I'm thinking about, which is a fantastic opera. And it's called Albert Herring. It's all about a boy who is quite simple in the village, and they're supposed to be trying to find the May Queen of the village. And it so transpires that none of the girls in the village are virtuous enough to be the May Queen. So they have to have a May King, which is a very unusual thing to have. So opera can take the storylines of anything, really. So that's, I would say, give opera a chance. It's just a different way of telling a story.
And this would be a lovely time to have your third bit of music.
So my third bit of music is Torches by Jean Joubert. It's a piece, again, from this book that I keep going on about of Christmas carols. It's Carols for Choirs, and there's about three volumes of it in the UK, and no choir is complete if they don't have a stock of Carols for Choirs, book 1, 2, and 3, but mainly books 1 and 2. And this song is... It's almost like a chant, torches, torches, run with torches all the way to Bethlehem. And it's got a beautiful middle section, which is more like a lullaby. But the sections that surround the middle section are very, very strong, very positive, with the use of the organ.
You've just heard Jean Joubert's Torches, Torches, Run with Torches. And I'm speaking to Abigail Kelly, soprano. You mentioned vocal warm-ups,
yes.
Abigail. And please tell us what those are.
So just like an athlete at the Olympics would need to stretch their muscles, make sure that they are physically in a state to complete, say, the 100 meters. When I'm teaching, I always give the analogy of, does Usain Bolt just get up out of bed in the morning and go running? No, he has to get up. He does his stretches. He makes sure that you'll see him on the track and he'll be jumping up and down. He'll be, you know, moving his body. It's exactly the same thing for singers. We have to do vocal warm-ups to make sure that we don't go straight into singing without warming our muscles, the tiny, teeny, tiny muscles and the tiny, tiny membranes that actually create the sound that sounds so, so big. So we have to make sure we warm those up, and it can be anything from making very silly sounds like rolling your R's like this, or buzzing your lips together, things like that. Then we'll sing on different vowel sounds. Some of them sound quite strange, and I've had the experience recently in Montserrat where the next door neighbour's dog has been taken aback by my vocal warm-ups. He's not been very happy at all. He's been barking at me, but I think I've regained his trust now. He comes and says hello to me now when I see him. But yes, those are the vocal warm-ups that I have to do before I sing. Sometimes it may take just a few minutes of vocal warm-ups to feel vocally ready to produce a sound. Other days, depending on how you're feeling, depending on maybe you might have a cold, your sinuses might be playing up, or maybe you just might be feeling quite emotional or tired, it may take a little bit longer to warm up vocally. So it, for me, sometimes it will take half an hour. It may even take an extended period of a couple of hours of on and off vocal warm-ups for me to really feel ready to sing.
And you're here with us under the tree because you very generously donated your time to doing a benefit concert for the St. Augustine School.
Yes.
And we are going to ask you about the preparation for that. Mm. But you came in, you flew in, and 2 days later you did this concert and you stood there and you did all of that. Did jet lag or any of those stresses, you know, have any effect on the type of performance you would have done?
I do worry that sometimes it does, but in actual fact, for the performance that just occurred, jet lag didn't really seem to affect me too much, especially because the performance was in the afternoon. So physically, my body actually felt quite nice and warm and ready. It felt like it was 8 o'clock at night, which is the kind of time that I would be performing. So for this concert, it wasn't really an issue. And then also in terms of the preparation for the concert, I'd done a lot of preparation in the UK beforehand in terms of making sure that all of the songs that I chose were songs that I knew, making sure that they were physically in my voice, in my body. By that I mean that that I could sing them at a moment's notice without worrying that I wouldn't be able to hit a certain note, for example. So a lot of preparation was done beforehand. And then when I got to the country, when I got to Montserrat, I was able, very fortunately, to have 2 days' worth of rehearsals for 2 hours each day with Rebecca, who was a fantastic pianist who we had, Rebecca Chalmers, who's here on the island. And the rehearsals went so, so smoothly. It was all so easy. It was all fantastic. So yes, it was quite an easy preparation coming to Montserrat to perform in the concert.
When we heard, those of us under the tree who heard you, when we heard you on stage, there's at least one person who said that you sounded like a lark.
Yes. That's so lovely. That's so kind. Sometimes people describe my sound, maybe not so much now, but when I was a bit younger, like a bell, which is another beautiful way of saying it. I love all of these different ways of describing voices. Sometimes people describe voices as being like velvet, which is a nice, rich, soft, warm sort of sound. Sometimes I'm bell-like. Maybe I might sound like a lark. And sometimes, hopefully, I sound like velvet too.
And you've traveled around the world, sharing that beautiful voice.
Yes, I've traveled quite a lot. I've been very fortunate. I've been to South Africa.